evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Sami Tay. Sami Tay is an internationally known musician, composer, and educator. He has released many highly acclaimed CDs, including the most recent 2005, Mbala Sasa. In 2002, Sami Tay founded a non-profit organization called Musicians for World Harmony, dedicated to healing through music. They visit the displaced, distressed, as well as orphanages throughout East Africa. Welcome to the show, Sami Tay.
Thank you.
You were born in Uganda. Tell us a little bit about your childhood and how you discovered music.
Oh, my childhood was actually really, really beautiful. I just remember just walking around, going, picking fruit, picking mangoes, finding sugar cane. And there was always music around. There was music. If you just went in the villages, there would be music for weddings, celebration, you know, there would be music for people going hunting. There will be music all the time. And then, of course, in my, you know, I spent a lot of time with my grandfather, and in that house there was always a lot of music too. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so I understand that your grandfather is the one that taught you the flute or introduced you to the flute.
Yes.
Yeah. To tell us about that.
How he was yeah, he was always waking up in the morning and playing the wooden flute. Mm. And I just remember just, you know, trying to imitate him, trying to do what he was doing, and eventually I was able to make the sounds. Mm-hmm. And also one of his sons actually played flute. He had told him, yeah.
And were you playing music, traditional music to Uganda, or stuff that your grandfather wrote?
Oh, no, this was not like written music. This is just inspired music by whatever is happening at the time.
So it has to do with life.
With life, yeah.
As it passes through.
Exactly. And the next day is something else. So it's not like a song, oh, let me play that song again. No.
Oh, that's fascinating. So I also read in your biography that your primary schooling was with the King's Courtyard Royal Musicians. Tell me about that. What does that mean? Did you just learn music?
No. But basically what happened is I went to school in the King's Palace. In my first days of school. So they were, you know, but there were always musicians there entertaining the king that pulled me in. Like, I would watch them, and I'd sit, watch them for hours when I was waiting for my parents to pick me up. And so it wasn't like I went to do music there, no.
So these people who were doing music sort of adopted you as a fellow musician?
No. I was tiny. I was really young. I just watched them. Every day, and the influence of, you know, the sounds as I saw them, the way they would bring in their instruments, the way they would start with one instrument and bring in another one, kind of improvise all the time, is what has influenced my music.
I see.
Yeah. No, I was really young. I'm talking of 4 years old.
Oh, 4 years old.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
I couldn't even handle the instruments at that point. But you were influenced, it sounds like.
Definitely, I was influenced,
Very fascinating. Mm-hmm. And so when did you actually start playing professionally and playing in front of people and composing?
Well, that's an interesting story, because in Uganda I used to do cover songs, but it wasn't until I left Uganda and I became a refugee in Kenya that I started writing my own music. Mm. That's when I started, you know, composing songs that reminded me of my childhood. That's when I started, you know, pulling traditional instruments into my life, because at that point I couldn't go back to Uganda and I needed anything that reminded me of the beautiful, beautiful life in Uganda when I was a kid. Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about leaving Uganda and going to Kenya? It happened in 1982, I believe.
Yes, it did.
What made you leave your homeland?
At that time in Uganda, many people were being kidnapped, and many of them would not come back. And my brother, my older brother, was taken away and tortured and killed.
Oh, geez.
And when that happened, he used to be, you know, like my, you know, I was closest to him. I have a very big family, about like 56, you know, children in the family.
Mm.
So you get a brother who is like your dad, you know, like your brother is, you know, like we divide ourselves in little groups.
Uh-huh.
And that was like my, you know, my own father almost, because he was responsible for
your role model.
You know, he was the one who would tell me, don't do that, or, you know, I'd fight with him. And so when he was taken away, I just, I felt like my life was in danger. In fact, seriously. And especially since at that time I had started performing and I was popular, so you become a threat to the regime.
Oh,
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Did you leave by yourself or did you bring family members?
I left with a friend who was also very popular. We were both singing in a band, which, you know, was called the African... Oh, excuse me. At that time, it was the Mixed Talents. We were playing in the Mixed Talents. And we just felt like life, you know, we were in danger. So we left and moved to Kenya.
Yeah. And so when you went to Kenya, you felt free enough to start writing?
No, well, I went through some difficult time. I went into a refugee camp, you know, for about 4 months. And then soon after that, I started composing my own music for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
African music, yeah.
And it was a comfort to probably recall your homeland and
exactly.
and sing some of the traditional songs from...
Exactly. What I would do, I'd compose these melodies, and then I would bring in some traditional folk stories or songs that I remember, and I'll combine them. And so basically, I was bringing Uganda to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But you were singing it in Kenya, I assume, in your mother tongue.
Yeah.
How did they receive it in Kenya? Did they understand the language?
No, they didn't understand the language, but they kind of welcomed me quite a bit. I mean, they would play me on the radio, and they would just call me our own son, which made me feel really welcome.
How bad.
On the radio. But they were mostly, you know, they didn't really care what language I sang in. No, mm-hmm. It didn't matter. And in fact, I've continued to do that. I sing in my own language
yes.
wherever I go. And it seems like it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, and yeah. I think you are proof that music is its universal language.
I think so,
yeah. I agree with you.
And it doesn't even matter what age.
Uh-huh.
It goes all the way from like tiny, tiny little one to, you know, 80-year-old.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, I want to play something from your 2005 CD, Embalasasa.
Mm-hmm.
The song is called Look for the Sunset. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, yeah. Look for the Sunset is, it's, you know, it so happens that my wife died 3 years ago. And I was, you know, I was one day wondering, I wonder what she's doing now, you know. Is mm-hmm. there something that we could do together? And that's what came to my mind, like, you know what, this beautiful sunset, mm-hmm. she's probably seeing it from another world. Because I somehow don't think we just disappear. I think we go somewhere. I don't know. I don't have any proof. But and then I thought, the one thing we can do together is see the sunset. So in this song, I'm telling her, look for the sunset, because, you know, then we can do something together.
Let's listen to it. It's really a gorgeous piece. I actually was listening to it all morning, and it's really touching. You can feel, without knowing the language, what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
It is very touching.
Mm-hmm.
I want to touch on also the fact that you emigrated to the U.S. Mm-hmm. in 1987. What made you come here?
What made me come to the U.S.? In Kenya at that point, my wife and I actually didn't feel very secure, didn't feel very safe. And we said, where do we go? So she said, come to Ithaca, because she used to live in Ithaca.
Really?
Yeah. So she brought me back to mm-hmm. Ithaca. But actually, she took me to New York City first.
What a change.
And,
Kenya to New York City.
And I hated New York City.
I can imagine.
You know, people were not making eye contact, and I would go to try to say hi to people. And people would, you know, hold their wallets. I'd be like, what's wrong with this guy?
Welcome to the U.S. and racism.
Yeah. And so I was like, oh, I need to be in a place where people look me in the eyes, mm-hmm. where people can say hi, you know. Mm-hmm. And when she said, well, you like Ithaca, she brought me and I've never left.
Yeah, it is a great place for the most part.
It's a beautiful place, yeah.
But what was happening in Kenya that made you have to leave there? It seems like you have to keep fleeing.
Well, I don't. I'm not fleeing anymore.
No.
But at that point in Kenya, you know, Kenya is full of refugees and full of people who are not good, who are escaping from the other governments, who are. Mm. So you don't know who you're dealing with. You don't know if you're dealing with an enemy, you know, somebody sent by the government to get rid of you or whatever. And so we at that point we had people following us, but we didn't know why. But
really?
Everywhere we went, you'd see two guys, almost like in a movie, you know, following you. And we didn't know who to ask, who they were. And so we just kind of, you know, once we proved that they were really always wherever we were, uh-huh. we decided to.
But you were becoming quite famous then, or you were somewhat famous.
I was
at that
kind
point,
of famous in uh-huh. Kenya, but my wife was also working for USAID. So we don't know if it was because of her job or that they wanted to make sure who she socialized with. We don't know who it was.
Yeah.
But we were being followed everywhere we went.
Oh, that would be really
disturbing.
Spooky. So you decided to flee, and obviously you got away from them.
Yeah, we decided to come back where things were different. And it was interesting just coming to the U.S. and there's so much freedom compared to those places, you know, mm-hmm. in Kenya. I just remember just looking at walking on the streets in New York City and seeing a mask of, you know, President Reagan. Somebody had made a mask and they were selling and people were, and I saw it and I ran right back into my apartment because I thought somebody's going to put me in jail for laughing and looking at this mask.
That's
I was
great.
Like, okay, I didn't see it. I didn't look at it, you know, because that could get you in trouble in the third world.
Uh-huh.
If you made fun of a president, uh-huh. you could get in trouble.
So you had to learn to navigate the whole new culture.
Oh, yeah.
You? Yes, and many people would have welcomed you laughing at Ronald Reagan.
No, at that point, it's like, I'm not going to laugh at this president, you know.
That's fascinating to me. Well, I also want to talk about the fact that you spent part of 1999 traveling through parts of Africa, and you filmed a PBS documentary called Song of the Refugee. Tell me about that. What was that experience like?
Oh, that was amazing. That was actually in 97 when we went.
Oh, was it 97?
Yeah, and it was, you know, one of those visits where we said, you know, I met a gentleman and he convinced me to go back to Africa. I was afraid because of what I was seeing in the media and what I ran away from. But he said, you know, we're always seeing negative things. Maybe we could go and tell a different story because people can't all be mean, you know. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. How did the whole continent turn into these monstrous people that the media is portraying?
Mm.
So we said, let's go see for ourselves. And of course, we found that it was totally different. I mean, yes, there were bad things. But it's just like concentrating, you know, just reporting on the U.S. in only a bad neighborhood and say this is what America is. But there's so many other beautiful things going on. There's a lot of love. People were sharing. People were giving. People were taking in children who'd been abandoned, poor people. And, mm-hmm. and everybody was, everywhere we went, people were giving us food. But what was really life-changing for me was that's when I discovered that I could play my flute or my kalimba and make a whole village of people or a refugee camp surround me and start singing. And it's not like I was playing like throughout. I'd do only like two songs and people would say, can we sing you a song also?
Mm-hmm.
So we did that from one village to another. Yeah.
And that, yeah. So did you find Africa much different than when you had left it in general?
I found that it was, other than the, you know, the difficult times that place, like we chose to go to the worst places.
Mm.
I found that Uganda was much better than when I left,
mm.
but I found that Liberia was worse than when I left. So, you know, and Rwanda, of course, had just gone through the genocide.
Oh, yes.
So that was a difficult time. And children had seen so much pain.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, I want to ask you to play something new
mm-hmm.
and something that you're working on. Tell us what it is and what it's for.
This one is, I'm working on a documentary soundtrack for a very special woman. Her name is Wangari Maathai, and she's an inspiration for me. I mean, she's she single-handedly just changed, you know, organized and changed,
mm-hmm.
you know, the way Kenya is going in terms of, you know, people planting trees and protecting the country that way.
Mm-hmm.
And the story is really big. So I'm working on the documentary. It's, you know, I'm doing the whole soundtrack for her documentary. And this is one of those pieces where, you know, she's actually young and going to the river and trying to get some water, and there are frogs. So this is a piece that I'm working for that.
Forward to hearing the whole soundtrack. I notice that you always sing in your native tongue, but
mm-hmm.
you often title
always.
Songs with English titles. Well, why do you do that?
I mix it up. Sometimes, you know, sometimes I get these songs that are in some weird language, like in my dream language. And it doesn't make any sense. So sometimes I give that an English title.
Things that don't make sense are in English.
Yeah.
Oh, Samite. Seriously, huh? Because you don't know how to put it into your native tongue's words?
No. Sometimes, actually, if I put it in my native tongue, it's too long, you know. And it won't, you know. And the thing is, I speak two languages.
Mm-hmm.
So I just kind of interchange. I mean, if you went with me to Uganda, you'd be surprised. Everybody speaks too. We mix it up, yeah. Are we going here to Gende? Like we're always mixing. It so happens that English is the language we use in Uganda
mm-hmm,
as
mm-hmm.
the main language, because we have 40 different tribes.
Mm.
So, and each tribe has their own language. So the only way we communicate, you know, is English. If you're going to respect the other tribe,
uh-huh.
Especially in places where people are educated. So we are always mixing it up.
Oh.
That's what happens.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people who speak several languages mix it up
mm-hmm.
a lot,
mm-hmm.
use the fun words from their native tongue and
yeah.
mix it in with English.
Yeah.
I also want to talk to you, of course, about the organization you founded in 2002,
mm-hmm.
Musicians for World Harmony. Tell
mm-hmm.
me about it. It's a wonderful organization.
Yeah, that Musicians for World Harmony was inspired when I went to do the PBS documentary. That's when I saw that just by playing the flute, I could make a child smile and I could make a child cry, actually, and tell me stories and then have him sing to me again, you know. And I came back to the U.S. and told my wife, you know what, Joanne, this is what I'm going to do the rest of my life. I'm going to figure a way of singing, you know, spending most of my time just singing for orphans, singing for refugees. So we started with friends here in Ithaca, we started this organization, Musicians for World Harmony. And what we do is we go to places in the world where people, you know, need to be uplifted, and we intend to take it all over the world, but we're doing pilot programs in East Africa,
mm-hmm.
Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania, and then we're going to expand, you know, all over. I'd like to see it all over the world. We've been to Latvia, actually.
Really?
Yeah, and performed for some refugees there, I mean orphans there. So in Kenya, we performed for AIDS orphans,
mm-hmm.
and it's just beautiful. And in fact, in one of the places we, in Kenya also, we bought a studio, a portable studio, because these children sing and they die, and people can't remember them,
uh-huh.
and at least the other kids who are alive would like to keep a part of them. So we thought, oh, a recording studio would be amazing. So we bought a portable recording studio. That's one of the things we've done, so that they could record themselves. And one of the, they actually recorded a CD, became number one.
Really? You
know, from that, yeah. And so the two orphanages have been using that studio. And we also sponsor musicians to continue going to the refugee camps and also to the orphanages. And we hope to be able to do it once we get the actual funding going. We hope we can do it more, because right now we're doing it at a smaller scale.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And how do you decide where to go? Do you keep touch with certain organizations to find out where the greatest need is?
Well, because that was in the initial thing, because right now we're working with certain, we're working with the Nyumbani, which is an orphanage in Nairobi.
Mm-hmm.
We're working with another one called Shangalia, which is also in Nairobi. And then in Uganda, we're working with SOS. And then ACAN, which is another organization that helps girls. Actually, it's called Action Against Child Abuse and Neglect,
mm-hmm.
ACAN.
Mm-hmm.
And they work with children who've been turned into child soldiers, at early ages of 8. And so we work with these 4 organizations at this point. We're not expanding too much.
Mm-hmm.
We are building programs with these organizations, and that's what... that's where we hope once these programs really get off the ground, then we can expand. And of course, like you answering your questions, we had to work with other organizations that are already doing other things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So these kids in these orphanages are going to be in those orphanages till they die, right? It's not like an orphanage
where they take them out.
No.
Especially like the Nyumbani one. That's the place for them to die. But many of them actually are now taking some medications, and they are not dying as fast.
That's the kids with AIDS. Huh?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But the ones like at Shangalia, which is another poor place, that one has a combination of children with AIDS and other children that have been abandoned from the streets who were addicted to glue. But they've introduced music to them and acting, and that helps them to stay focused and go to school.
Mm-hmm.
So we were working with them and trying to see how we can help. And we are now connected, making connections with other organizations in the U.S., like the Berklee College of Music.
Mm-hmm.
They have a music therapy department. We are talking, see what we can do with them and see how, using their music therapy and working with us, see what we can do to help these orphanages.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Have you always known that music would be a healing force?
No.
No?
It was healing for me when I was in Kenya, when I was a refugee.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife encouraged me to record it, but it was mostly for healing myself. And then she said other people will relate to it. She convinced me. And then, of course, when I went to these parts of Africa, like in Cote d'Ivoire and Rwanda and Liberia, that's when I discovered that just the flute could make somebody feel better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a really healing force.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how people have discovered that, but it's an absolute fact.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you seem to have a special place in your heart for children,
mm-hmm.
because you do outreach education for children and
mm-hmm.
workshops and performances. Tell me a little bit about working with children in the schools.
It's always amazing. It's very rewarding. They are very open. They ask whatever they want to ask, and they tell you whatever they want to tell. This, and that's what I like about them. I try to stay, I try to learn from them, because if you hear my music, I try to stay like a child. I don't develop it too much. I leave it at that.
Mm-hmm.
And we all have it in ourselves, but we try to cover it up. And I see it during my performances. I see people beginning to feel like children again, and they start smiling, and they start jumping just like little kids.
Uh-huh.
And it doesn't matter what age. And I think it's because of, what we all want to, we cover it up because we're supposed to grow up. But we have that pure you know, in that pure soul,
innocence.
Uh-huh. That's exactly the right word. We have that innocence that you only get from children, and when I'm with them, it just reminds me where to go.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So that's your joy of working with children.
Exactly. Well,
do you actually teach kids how to play some of your instruments and
perform? Not necessarily. I let them, you know, I show them the instruments. I let them touch the instruments. I show them some rhythm, and I let them sing with me. I let them, you know, express themselves. And every once in a while, somebody says, "Can I also sing a song?" And yesterday when we did it, they were really, really young this time. It changes, you know, sometimes they are a little older, but they were really young. And one said, "I want to sing a song." And then she came on stage and she said, "You do it."
And so you never got her to sing?
No, then she went and got her little sister to sing and told her, "You sing, sing, sing." So it's always a surprise.
That's great. And you also work some with adults.
Oh, I do a lot of universities, you know, wherever I go. Uh-huh. And, you know, I go places where I also do hospitals.
Mm-hmm. You know, just sharing the joy.
And it's always exciting to see, you know, people close, you know, they don't open up at first, especially in places where they're not used to mm-hmm. seeing black people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and then I say, "Can I sing you a song?" And then they're like shrugging their shoulders, "I don't care." And then, you know, they're sick in their bed, dying of cancer or something. And then soon I just say, you know, I just play a little thing. And then soon it's like, "What is that you have around your neck?" You know, then you know you're already breaking in. And then mm-hmm. a few minutes later he's telling you about, you know, "I hope this chemo works, you know, and my wife is alone." I mean, you've already...
Oh, yeah.
So it happens again and again.
It makes a human connection.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we are almost out of time. How can people get in touch with you and your organization if they would like
yes.
to?
Yes. They can visit musiciansforworldharmony.org and you can, you know, online, and you can email us from there.
Uh-huh.
musiciansforworldharmony.org.
And do you also have a website?
It's the website. If they want to reach me, they can actually go to my website, which is samite.com, samite.com.
Well, that's great. Thank you so much for being with us. It's been a pleasure talking to you, Samite.
Thank you very much.
Our audio producer is Tim Reppert at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are a project of the Women's Interfaith Institute in Seneca Falls. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And log on to our new website at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.